This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. You might not think that tax proposals and political wrangling over seats on Senate committees could inspire primetime television drama, but then you're not Lawrence O'Donnell. O'Donnell is the creator and executive producer of the new NBC show Mr. Sterling, about a principled freshman senator from California as he negotiates the compromises of life on Capitol Hill. The production has a certain authenticity in its dialogue and details, much of which is drawn from O'Donnell's own years of experience in Washington as a senior aide to Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan. In the early 90s, O'Donnell served as chief of staff of the U.S. Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works and as Democratic chief of staff of the U.S. Senate Committee on Finance. O'Donnell's credits also include a tour of duty in the Oval Office, the television Oval Office, that is. For the first two seasons, he was a writer and producer for the other political drama on NBC, The West Wing. O'Donnell is also the senior political analyst for MSNBC. In the new show, Bill Sterling has been chosen to replace a senator who was removed from office midterm. Sterling's father was a very popular Democratic governor of California, but the son surprises everyone when it turns out he's an independent, not a Democrat. This gives him a lot of leverage to negotiate with the leaders of a Senate that's evenly divided. In this scene, he's meeting with top Democrats in the Senate, the majority leader, and the chairs of Appropriations and Finance.
What I want. There's a seat on Appropriations now and a seat on Finance now. Not the next opening on Finance, but right now.
But we don't have an opening on Finance now.
You could make one if you were to give up your seat on the Finance Committee.
Well, that's ridiculous. You know, I couldn't do that. The majority leader always has a seat on the Finance Committee.
Well, it's not a rule, majority leader being on finance. It's just a tradition.
What are you saying?
I'm saying if you let Senator Sterling walk through that door, you'll still have your seat on finance, but you won't be majority leader anymore.
And we won't be chairman.
And would you want to bet on Dan and Roger here voting for you for minority leader if you lost their chairmanships for them?
You can't come into my office and try to dictate to me what...
Easy, come on, sit down. Now, do you want to keep this office or not?
It's a deal.
Lawrence O'Donnell, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
Could you please give us a profile of Mr. Sterling, how this former prosecutor ended up a senator from California?
Well, there's a little bit of the Jerry Brown in him. What I was thinking about in this character was someone who was living the modern-day version of monastic life, which Jerry Brown actually did for some period before he got into politics. It was pretty clear that at the outset of his adulthood, Jerry Brown was avoiding the life path of his father, who had been California governor and very popular. And he was avoiding it in the most opposite possible course. And then it became kind of fascinating to me that he ended up doing it. So we found him. When I thought about where are we going to find this guy, who we will then appoint to the Senate, I wanted to find him. If we were doing this 500 years ago, we'd find him in a monastery, and my version of that was he's teaching in a prison in California in a high school program that he invented for that prison, because for me that is one of the great lost causes in America, one of the great possible endeavors that's been completely given up, which is the possibility of redirecting the lives of convicts after they've been imprisoned. And so here he was doing this completely ignored task that required a kind of toughness and practicality and political ability, actually, that would be very valuable when plunged into the Senate. And that's where he begins in this story.
Sterling is an independent, it turns out. No one knows this. He's appointed by the by the governor of California to the Senate to fill a spot that was vacated by a really nasty crook. But once he's installed, it turns out he's a registered independent. Why did you go down that route? Why an independent?
Well, one thing that it did dramatically for the show was it made him incredibly powerful on his first day in the Senate. It is not that interesting for television dramatic purposes, although fascinating for if you actually live through it. But it's not that interesting for television dramatic purposes to be the 100th ranking senator in the United States Senate, the most recent arrival, utterly powerless, and in no position to affect anything. And his arriving as an independent in an evenly split Senate, similar to what we've had for the last few years, could tip the balance of power one way or the other. So suddenly he becomes instantly powerful on his first day when each party is pursuing him to get him to join their side. And in that pursuit of him, he exercises his powers in such a way and leverage to get some great committee assignments that will put him in the thick of all of the action in the Senate.
Now, I understand you had this whole backstory to this character, that he came from a monastic frame of mind, and also has, and the storyline is developed in the show, has a father who was a very popular politician, a governor of California, and there's a father-son conflict. But I was curious, and I'm always curious when I watch The West Wing, another show that you worked on, and when I watch Mr. Sterling, whether you ever considered making the star of a show about Washington a conservative Republican, and would that make for good television?
Yeah, you know, I haven't considered it. And you're going to get flack from one side or the other, and I'm actually now getting flack from both, whenever you make that party selection of the character. Look, I'm Irish. I'm from Boston. I worked for a liberal Democratic New York senator in the United States Senate. I don't really if I'm going to depart from write what you know, I don't know in the fullest possible authorial way how to really write as my lead character a conservative Republican senator. So that's my confession as a fiction writer. I don't know how to do it. I have tremendous fun writing the conservative Republican characters in the show, and I like them actually better than the Democratic characters. They are just much more fun to me, and the way I play them, they're actually much more honest, and I think as characters, they are generally more admirable. But I really wouldn't know how to take a conservative Republican all the way through this kind of show. And I said publicly, I've said this publicly once before in the New York Times, and I got an awful lot of criticism from it from Republicans. But I think dramatically it's more difficult because in fundamental terms, the Republican position in government is no, which is to say, no, we don't want to do that activist thing. And the Democratic position in government is generally more activist. And when you're writing drama, writing the guy who doesn't want to do something is a very difficult protagonist to have in your show. And writing the person who does want to do something, well, gee, you know, that gets you Spider-Man and that gets you everything else that you want in drama. So that's my little difficulty in it. I would love to see someone do it. I think, I don't know who that writer is because, you know, the truth of it is that the Writers Guild of America, my union, Show Business Writing, is a minimum of 95% to 99% liberal Democrat. So don't hold your breath for us coming up with the interesting conservative Republican lead of a television show.
Now, you, in the late 80s, you were a senior advisor to Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, and you were director of communications in the senator's 88 reelection campaign. You went on to hold several job titles in the U.S. Senate as a key aide to Moynihan. What kind of deal-making and compromises did you experience in those years that gave you fodder for writing a television show about the Senate?
Well, the real big boost that happened to Senator Moynihan and to me was with Bill Clinton's election. Lloyd Benson, who was the chairman of the Finance Committee, went on to Treasury, and Senator Moynihan became chairman of finance. I became chief of staff of the Senate Finance Committee. The Senate Finance Committee collects virtually 100% of the American government's revenue and spends about 60% of it. Bob Woodward wrote a book called The Agenda, which covered President Clinton's first year. All of it was about business in the Senate Finance Committee. You couldn't be more in the thick of it and the deal-making and the crucial deal-making than I was at that time. And mostly it was incredibly exciting, exciting beyond description in many ways. And most of it involved what in dramatic terms would be really honorable depictions of backroom life, kind of spiritually comparable to movies like The 12 Angry Men, and but some of it, of course, involved really crass political calculation. You know, we're not going to be able to get that guy's vote because in his state, the oil interests are such that he won't be able to vote for this or that. But that stuff actually tends to be rather understandable, and it doesn't feel particularly sleazy when you come up against it. You know, if the guy's from an oil state, there are just certain things you're not going to be able to get from him, and you know that's democracy. Oil states get to have senators, and it's basically my view of it, and my view of government ended up being far more positive than it would have been if I had never worked in government. I was a pretty cynical. Cynical leftist, extreme leftist, before working in government. I considered myself to live outside of the parties. I mean, I was referred to as a Democrat when I was working on the Democratic side of the Senate, but I, you know, considered myself some kind of European socialist who was just, you know, living outside of this. And that position actually gave me a way of seeing how similar it all is. How I was always concentrating on how little difference there was between Democrats and Republicans. And if you live, you know, deeply within one of those parties, all you see is the differences. And I think that's the least interesting thing about them.
So how did this experience translate to television? And I should say you're a veteran of the West Wing also. You were one of the writers and a senior story editor on that show. So what did you bring with you from government? What were you looked to advise on in writing this for television?
You know, my career actually was – I was a writer and a show business writer before I ever stumbled into politics and government. So when I came out of government in the end of 1995 – and consolidated in Los Angeles. I was really just getting back into the business that I left in 1987 to go join a Senate campaign and then end up working in the United States Senate. So when the West Wing started up, my name was on the list of people that they would want to call to bring in as a writer. And that's not surprising. And so I signed up right away. And I had the huge advantage in the writing room at the West Wing of having experience, of having been in real working business meetings in the Oval Office and in the Cabinet Room. My experience was much richer on the Capitol Hill side of things, but I certainly had enough experience to come up with story ideas for the White House. And I also knew what questions to ask Dee Dee Myers and other consultants on the show who had worked in the White House. And so it was actually a pretty easy show for me to work on because of that.
What were some of your storylines that people would recognize that you came up with?
Well, one, and this is typical of the kind of my explorations as a writer, one in the first season was President Bartlett's confrontation with the death penalty, where I knew that federal death penalty cases were ripening to the point where we had an execution close to being scheduled, and I wanted to see that. I wanted to see a president who thought this kind of thing was never going to come his way put back in that position that governors are in as the clock is approaching midnight, and what is he going to do? And the only thing that interested me as a lifelong, a very simple, moralistic opponent of the death penalty, the only thing that interested me was I wanted to see the president kill the guy. Because I know what it is to not kill the guy. I know what it is to let that go, to commute the sentence. I don't know what it is for an honorable man, or one who aspires to be an honorable man and a moral man, and in this case a Roman Catholic, to be placed in that life or death decision-making position and to decide in favor of the killing. I don't know what that is. And so I and Aaron Sorkin right away, as soon as I proposed the story to him, agreed that dramatically the best thing to happen here is for the president to go through with it, because we've all seen the he commutes the sentence with 1 minute left on the clock 1,000 times. And so both dramatically and then in character terms, it was just far more interesting to me to go against what I would do. And I tend to do that most of the time in this kind of writing because my position interests me the least.
You wrote for The West Wing, and then you conceived of this Mr. Sterling idea. What did you want to do with Mr. Sterling that you couldn't do on The West Wing?
Well, it's a completely different arena. Frequently, I'd be sitting on my hands at The West Wing with a story idea that wouldn't work because we don't have, at The West Wing, you know, we didn't have a Senate hearing room, or we couldn't spend that much time off of our sets. And this, you know, I'd come up with a story, I'd think of a story that involved maybe only Josh going up to Capitol Hill for two acts of the show, and that just would unbalance things in a way that, that wouldn't work. And so there were plenty of ideas that I came up with that we just couldn't use there that I could absolutely use in a Senate show. I always wanted to do a Senate show, and I wanted to do one before I went to work at The West Wing. The pilot script for Mr. Sterling was actually written over 10 years ago in 1992. I wrote that as a spec movie script that after Bill Clinton got elected, I never had the time to go and rewrite. I was writing that one on the side while I was working in the Senate and never looked at it again until after the first 2 years of working at The West Wing. But when I went to The West Wing, I always knew that you know, this would be great and this would be fun for some limited amount of time, and then I want to get on to creating my own show, and the Senate show is probably the best thing to do because West Wing had paved the way so brilliantly.
Well, the thing about The West Wing is it's in the Oval Office. It's some exciting stuff, White House politics often, but the work of the Senate can be so mind-numbing, I think. Is The Hill harder to turn into good TV?
No, the reality is that The Hill is a far more dramatic place. The West Wing is one of the most boring places in Washington. It's quieter than a library. There's no one running around the way they run around in the West Wing set. It's a truly boring place. It's also the only place in the history of television sets where in the reality of it, you have to get clearance by the Secret Service to get in. So there's no uncomfortable encounter literally in the West Wing. You have to get them off the set for that to happen. And in the Congress, as the second a senator steps outside of his or her office and steps into the hallway of the Russell Senate office building, they can literally be verbally attacked by 100 protesters following them down the hall, angry about them because of their position one way or another on abortion or the environment or something like that. There are also there's 100 of these rich characters called senators who can interact with each other in more powerful ways than is possible for someone to interact with President Bartlet on the West Wing. You know, Bartlet is the king. There's no other dynamic going on there. He's the king. No one more powerful, more threatening can ever enter the room in that show, ever. Not once, not for a minute, not even theoretically, somewhere else in the world. And that, to me, is an incredible writing challenge that Aaron Sorkin at The West Wing meets brilliantly, absolutely brilliantly. I mean, if I were to sit down pre-West Wing and if someone were to say to me, propose shows to me, saying, look, we'd like you to do a show called The West Wing, set in the West Wing of the White House, using all those characters that you know, or a show called, you know, Mr. Somebody or, you know, Senator So-and-so, set on Capitol Hill using the Senate, I would say, oh, please let me do the Senate because that's much richer dramatically. Now, I'm not asking audiences to agree with me on that based on the episodes they've seen of Mr. Sterling or of The West Wing at this point. I'm just saying for me as a writer, finding the dramas and finding the tensions and playing them in ways that interest and amuse me, it's a much richer world.
So how did you get into politics?
Well, very much against my will. There was a Writers Guild strike in 1988 that lasted 6 months. And during that time, Senator Moynihan had begun running for re-election, and Mrs. Moynihan, his wife, was the campaign manager, and I knew them both, as friendly with both of them. And I would have dinner with them occasionally and say how easy this campaign looked to me, a mere citizen observer of these things. And so, you know, we engaged in this campaign, and Moynihan won with 67 or 8% of the vote, which was his normal vote count. And at the end of that process, he took me out to lunch the day after the election and said, well, what do you want? And I thought he meant, what do I want for lunch? You know, what sandwich do I want? And what he meant was, what job do I want in the Senate? And I didn't want a job in the Senate. I was a writer, and I was going to go do more Hollywood writing stuff. I didn't want to have anything to do with this. The Writers Guild strike was over by that time. I could go back to Hollywood and, you know, try to make easy money typing. And he said, well, I'd like you to be my senior advisor. And you know, you can write on the side if you want to. And I thought, okay, a senior advisor to a guy who needs no advice. Now, that sounds like the job for me. I think I'm up for that. I can handle that. And that just got more and more involving. I always expected to leave the Senate payroll next month or next week, that something would come up in my writing career that would force me to do that. Nothing ever did. And, you know, 7.5 years later, I was still on the Senate payroll and just then getting around to leaving. And my tenure there surprised everyone who knew me before I got into politics and government. And then I ended up staying in it long enough that what I'm doing now surprises everyone who knew me in politics and government. And I guess only to me does it all make sense.
So certainly Moynihan played a huge role in your career. He influenced it. But how much of an influence was he on your life, your thinking, your political life?
Pat Moynihan was the greatest thing that ever happened to me, and what's really delightful about it is that he enters my life so graciously and easily that I don't even notice for years that he is the greatest thing that ever happened to me. But I can actually now look and see that everything I've done since leaving the Senate has been based on having worked there. And I never would have predicted that, because when I was working in the Senate, I always knew I'm going to have nothing to do with this when I leave. I am not going to be a $1 million lobbyist when I leave the Senate Finance Committee, like everyone else who had held that job before me goes on to do. I'm going to leave Washington. I'm not going to ask them to confirm me to anything. I don't want anything. And yet, I ended up back in the scriptwriting world where I was before, but all of the scriptwriting I've done since leaving the Senate has used that experience, both at the West Wing and now at Mr. Sterling. And, you know, my work as a television political analyst at MSNBC and appearing on the McLaughlin Group is all based on having worked on the Senate and worked in the Senate. I just never anticipated that it would turn out that way.
How does Senator Moynihan enter into your thinking when you're writing for television? Do you ever think, say, if you're writing about President Bartlet when you wrote for the West Wing, did you think, well, what would Moynihan do here?
He is so much in my brain all the time that I never really think, what would Moynihan do here? I did at the West Wing, because I have to say, when I started at the West Wing, I had real trouble conceiving of an honorable president. I had never witnessed one in my adulthood, you know, which in presidencies are my consciousness, which in presidencies really spanned from Lyndon Johnson through to Bill Clinton, and I worked with Bill Clinton fairly closely, and so just ended up through that having a kind of lower opinion of him with every professional encounter. But that's a whole long story, which has nothing to do with Monica Lewinsky or political ideology and everything to do with just effectiveness and professionalism in the workplace, which he was not great at. And so I just didn't admire presidents. I there was not one in my life that I admired other than JFK when I was a child. And so I didn't know how to write the admirable president. And so, yes, every once in a while I would say to myself at the West Wing in the first year, what would Senator Moynihan do? Because in Senator Moynihan and working with him for 7 years, I met and worked with and in every real kind of way lived with for 7 years, the most honorable person I have ever known.
What do you consider your biggest success of your time in politics?
I don't think of myself as having had a success. I was simply one of those geeks you see sitting behind the senators in C-SPAN in those hearings. And there's nothing that matters in that picture other than the senators, especially when you work for a senator like Pat Moynihan. The line on Moynihan was, he's the only guy in Washington who's smarter than his staff. And whether he's the only guy, I don't know. But it is absolutely true that he's smarter than his staff. And so, this is like asking, you know, Laurence Olivier's makeup man, what was his greatest acting triumph? And you just go, well, I mean, I really loved that Hamlet he did and all. But it's really, it wasn't about me. Everything that happened in American government would have happened if I wasn't there.
So what made you leave politics?
Everybody leaves politics. Everybody leaves politics. They burn out. They're underpaid for their market skills anyway. The thing that's inexplicable to me are the people who don't leave. Having said that, let me explain why I left politics. I did 7 years there, and by that time, my daughter was a year old, and she was living. She was never living in Washington, and so I was a father away from my daughter, who was up in New York, and I left, quote, for family reasons. That thing that you read in the paper and have a right to almost never believe. I never believed it. Before I worked in government, when I read so-and-so left for family reasons, I knew that was a lie and that he left because he knew he couldn't win his reelection or he left for some other reason. But half of the people who say they leave for family reasons are telling the truth. Because it is such a, you're so separated from your children and from your real life when you're in one of those things. It's like working in a submarine. And when you get out, it feels like you got out of a submarine. It is exhilarating when you get out. I thought when I left the Senate that I'd be sitting up in my apartment in New York with my then-year-old daughter just watching C-SPAN all day, because I really did love it. I liked it so much.
What did you love about it? What?
I don't know. It's a junky thing, you know. It's indescribable, because I really was, you know, the geek behind the senator on C-SPAN. What can possibly be exciting about that? I don't know. It's the book I haven't written and actually attempted to write. I had a book contract coming out of the Senate to write my Senate memoirs, as it were, and I just couldn't get it down. Because I went from being someone who had no real interest in current government, now that all the major crises were over, like the Vietnam War and the Cold War and the major civil rights issues, to being someone who, sitting on the floor of the Senate, watching Senator Moynihan give a speech on Social Security, could be brought close to tears. Now, that's a level of policy geekery that is inexplicable to civilians, and I can't even attempt to do it.
Well, this is during the Clinton years. Did you identify with the policy wonks of the Clinton administration, with the tenor of that staff?
That's a hugely exaggerated notion, that either President Clinton was a policy wonk or anyone working in the West Wing was a policy wonk, other than Gene Sperling. And that's just the rap. That's the image they wanted for themselves, and the positive wrapping they wanted for that president. He was no more of a policy wonk than any other presidents. In my experience, being in the Oval Office with Bill Clinton, he knew about an index card worth of material. I'll put it this way: I was never in a meeting with Bill Clinton and senators where Bill Clinton was not the single most ignorant person in the room. And I don't say that as a criticism. That's normal. He's from out of town. He's just coming from a governorship. He didn't have Medicare under his jurisdiction in Arkansas. He didn't have Social Security. He didn't have trade. So they don't know anything. These governors that we make president, you know, it's like taking the president of Avis and making him the president of Warner Brothers. What do you think he knows on the first day? Nothing. But the image that Clinton easily achieved was that he knew more than most presidents. That's because up against the White House press corps, that's a really easy thing to achieve, because no one's allowed 3 follow-up questions in a row. if they were, you'd discover that, I guess he has that one rap on Medicare, but he doesn't have anything else, does he?
What are your impressions of White House culture in the Bush administration?
I'm hugely impressed by it. I have to tell you, I envy it a little bit because, you know, I think, you know, you get to work with one president in your lifetime. Everyone does, don't they? I certainly was only going to get to work in one White House. That is to say, come into a White House and do business with it. And it turned out to be the Clinton White House, which was a disastrously messy, badly run White House because all organizations resemble their head. And, you know, that the head of that organization was just nutty. And I think we all now know that through various House investigations about what he was doing with his spare time. And Bush is so disciplined. This is totally policy aside because I really don't, you know, find myself in agreement, personal agreement politically with the Bush administration on much or anything that I can think of. But it's an extremely disciplined place. And it runs in a wonderfully efficient way. And Karl Rove has brought such a smart, organized intelligence to the overall political view and the political interconnectedness of everything. And, you know, and the rest of the staff there have made – Andy Card has run the most stable West Wing that we have seen possibly since they built the West Wing. And he's a completely egoless White House chief of staff who does a tremendous job and knows how to do it. And I would love to have come into that kind of White House to do business instead of coming into a White House where people feared who is going to tell this bad news about this vote count to the president's wife. Because no one wants to do that, because if they do, they will be perceived by various people as an enemy. You know, it was madness. It was just madness and unprofessional and rampantly so. And it was you know, as bad as any Hollywood studio I've ever had to deal with.
You know, what I find very interesting about these shows about Washington, your show and the West Wing, is how much viewers get caught up in the politics of the show and kind of confuse the politics of television
with
the real politics and project their own fantasies on the shows. I'm sure probably if you held a vote tomorrow, people would vote for President Bartlett of the West Wing over a real politician. Yeah. Now, do you have your own stories about the line between TV Washington and real Washington being crossed?
Well, for me, the line couldn't be clearer, and they are just totally separate things. But for everyone else, there's some kind of weird blur, and I don't understand it at all. You know, I think President Bartlett now is pretty liberal. I mean, he's actually reversed himself on the death penalty, and he's opposed to the death penalty now. But in the first 2 years of the show, when I was there, people would say, oh, you know, liberal Bartlett. And I would say, well, why? Recite for me the list of positions he has that are liberal. Because there really wasn't much of one. And yet they just, because he looked like a liberal or something, I don't know, he had hair like a Kennedy, so he must be a liberal. And there's a lot of that that goes on, and it goes on with my show too. I mean, I have Republicans who say to me, oh, come on, Sterling's just a liberal Democrat. Well, Sterling is in favor of school vouchers. Sterling is opposed to the death penalty, which I'm afraid no liberal Democrats are, so-called liberal Democrats. I mean, you know, there's two. There's Russ Feingold, there's Ted Kennedy, that's it. You know, maybe I'm forgetting someone else, but that's about it. And, you know, Republicans will say to me, why don't you just say he's a liberal Democrat? I say, well, because, you know, he's not. And the reason they're saying that is because Sterling tonight, or, you know, Friday night at 8 on NBC, is not coming out for a massive tax cut or for whatever, you know, the current, you know, conservative Republican orthodoxy is. And so if you don't, the audience, the political audience that watches these things will project onto your character no matter what you do. They will project him to be more liberal than he is. They will project him to be less conservative, unless you do exactly what they want. And then he's the thing they don't want. They just will refuse to try to take in the political subtleties of who these people can be.
Lawrence O'Donnell, it was a lot of fun talking to you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much. I really enjoy it.
Lawrence O'Donnell is the creator and executive producer of Mr. Sterling. It airs Friday nights on NBC.